Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
How are we doing?
Good.
Thank you. Good. Beautiful weekend, huh? Woohoo! Yeah. We don't need spring in Wisconsin. We just get winter and summer. We're good. And a little bit of fall. Hey, I just want to thank you for being here this morning. And if this is one of your first times here, thank you for investing your morning with us. Our desire here at Faith Community is to help you, and wherever you're at, to help you take next steps in following after Jesus. And so, if this is your first time ever being in a church or your first time being here or you've been here a couple times, right after the service, we'll have our Connection Center open, which is this room over here, and we'll have representatives over there, hosts, help you take the next steps in following Jesus. Also, because we desire to help you where you are, right where you are, that's one of our goals, is to make more and better disciples of Jesus. If you have any questions about anything I say during this teaching time, please feel free to come up right after the service, and I'd love to talk with you about how this could be applied to your life, or any questions you might have of any disagreement or something, or if this has just been the best sermon you've ever heard in your life. You know, tell Tim Prince, because he's preaching next weekend. Where are you, brother? There you are. No, tweet that. No, just kidding. I'd love to hear your encouragement as well. I mentioned a couple weeks ago that as a family, we have entered into a new phase. We are now touring college campuses, university campuses, to see where the Lord might be leading our oldest son, Levi. And for those of you who have gone through it and some of you who are still anticipating it, you can imagine that right now for us as mom and dad, as husband and wife, we are unusually emotional. And unusually, even for me, internally introspective and reflective. And, you know, one of the things that happens when you are looking at places to leave your son for many years is you wonder, have we prepared him well enough for this next step? And you wonder, and sometimes you're afraid, and sometimes you see little glimpses of, yeah, he's ready to go. And sometimes there's tension, and you're thinking, yeah, you need to go right now. But there's been this sort of this strange and unplanned overlap with our season in life as a family with going through Proverbs together as a church, because even though Proverbs has a lot of knowledge in it, and there's a lot of poetry, and there's a lot of wise sayings in it, sometimes we can forget the familial a context in which this book was written. It's written by a father to a son, by a mother to her son. It's a family ordeal where one generation is passing on wisdom to another generation, father who is casting a vision for what the fullness of life can look like, and then with vested interest because he wants the greatest for his son, talks to him about this is how to experience fullness of life in this world. Please listen to my words. Please give all of your attention to what I'm telling you and how to live. What Proverbs is after, and today as we look at our passage, what the father is after for his son is called peace. Or if you've been around church for a while, or maybe you know some people who are Israeli, Israelites or Jewish, that maybe you've heard the word shalom. Shalom is the Hebrew word for peace. And we tend to think about peace as the absence of war, which shalom has that as a part of absence, as a part of it as its definition, the absence of war. But it's actually bigger than that. It's sort of like a combination of what we would say of wholeness. Or even though there's some difficulties with it, how our culture, we tend to talk about human flourishing. That's what shalom is, and that's what we're made for. That's what God has for us. This is what the Father is pouring into his Son. Give your life to these things, and you will experience human flourishing. You will experience shalom. You will experience wholeness. You will experience what you were made to experience if you give yourself to these things. And as we'll see in the text here in just a moment, that to get it, to get that human flourishing, to get that shalom, to experience that shalom, the Father teaches his Son in this passage that you have to gain wisdom. You need wisdom to be able to experience the shalom that you're made for. And before we look at themes in this letter, themes in this book of Proverbs about wisdom in certain areas of life, about self-control, about pride, about humility, about anger, about how to use our words well, about how to make wise financial decisions, how to invest our money well. Before we look at those themes, there's one other, this passage here reminds us that wisdom is not so much about knowledge, it's about the heart that you bring into life. It's about the type of heart that you have. And today we're going to look at Proverbs 3. And we're just going to look at verses 1 through 12 here this morning. And if you don't have a Bible, you can use one of the Bibles in the chairs in front of you. Also, it's in the worship folder and the inside cover of your worship folder. And in coming weeks, one of the reasons why we're printing the scripture passages in the worship folders, in coming weeks, we're going to be jumping all over the place in Proverbs. And so, but today, it just so happens that we're going to look at a large chunk that's focused on the heart. And we're looking at Proverbs 3, 1 through 12. And we're just going to look under two headings this morning. God-centered hearts is what we need. God-centered hearts that are secured by steadfast love. God-centered hearts that are secured by steadfast love. That's the type of heart that you and I need if we're going to gain the wisdom that we need to flourish in life. Proverbs 3. Wow, I can just envision myself. I have remembrances of talking this way to Levi and to our boys. My son, do not forget my teaching. Let your heart keep my commandments. For length of days and years of life and peace they will add to you. Let not steadfast love and faithfulness forsake you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart so you will find favor and good success in the sight of God and man. Trust in the Lord with all of your heart, and do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight, or make straight your paths. Be not wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn from evil. It will be healing to your flesh and refreshment to your bones. Honor the Lord with your wealth and the first fruits of all of your produce. Then your barns will be filled with plenty, and your vats will be bursting with wine. My son, do not despise the discipline, the Lord's discipline, or be weary of his reproof. For the Lord reproves him whom he loves as a father the son in whom he delights. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now again, Proverbs is filled with all kinds of practical advice that we will be looking at through the summer months. We're going to get to that practical advice, but just like last week where we talked about how there's a fear that our hearts need to have that's bigger than any other fear if we're going to live with wisdom, we need to have our hearts tuned rightly here if we're going to gain wisdom. That's what the passage is emphasizing. There's not a lot of practical advice in this one other than to speak to the heart. Notice some of the words that are used in this section. It's speaking to our affections, to our desires. Trust in the Lord with all of your heart. Acknowledge him in all your ways. Fear the Lord. Honor the Lord. Do not despise the Lord's discipline. Gaining wisdom, the wisdom that you and I need to experience flourishing in life, that gaining must come because we have a God-centered heart. A God-centered heart. Now, we're going to look at what that God-centered heart looks like here. And as I was going through and studying this week, it was helpful to me to look at these commands, trust and acknowledge and fear and honor, as the two and a call away from something else. And so I want to put this in a from-to kind of relationship. The commands are to something, but they're calling us from something as well. A God-centered heart, if we look at verses, or if you see in verses 3 and 4, trust in the Lord with all your heart, or there is to take steadfast love and faithfulness and to bind it to your neck and to write it on your heart. There's a call away from callous independence as a human being. A call away from callous human being independence to love and faithfulness for others. Timothy Keller, in his book, The Meaning of Marriage, talks about how there's this new thing that's come about in our culture called, some have called, the commodification of relationships. The commodification. We're involved with people only if we personally benefit more than it costs us to be in the relationship. We think that we flourish only because of our involvement with people who fill our tanks. This is callous independence. We're only in relationships as far as they can benefit us. It's also self-centeredness. People exist for me and my life. It's living by the narrative, your life for mine. But what Proverbs reminds us is that the core of all existence is a God who says, my life for yours. And we flourish as human beings, though it's painful. We flourish when we actually live out and have at the center of our core of our being a love and a faithfulness, a desire to do good to as many people as we possibly can, and faithfulness to stick with our promises, even when it's hard. God-centeredness is basically a love for one another. Remember, the greatest command is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And the second is, like it, to love your neighbor as yourself. That's what steadfast love and faithfulness is. It's a determination to live for the good of your neighbor and the people around you. Proverbs is actually built, as we'll see, the relational wisdom of Proverbs is built off of the second command to love your neighbor as yourself. That's how the whole relational wisdom theme runs through Proverbs. Verses 5 and 6 of this section have another from 2, if we want to look at it that way. It's from self-determination. From self-determination, I am the master of my own fate. I am the captain of my own ship, to God's path. It's a movement away from an attitude that I'm here to make my mark, and I'm here because I'm here to make my mark in human history, to instead, I'm here because of a God who made me, a God who's given me the gifts and talents, and I'm here to serve him with my gifts and talents and everything that I have. It's a call away from a desire to make a name for ourselves, instead to humbly receive and to use everything that we have to give glory to God and honor to him. God's wisdom can only be received with humility, a humble heart. Verses 7 through 8 have a move as well, from my own morals to God's morals. Being wise in my own eyes, I'm going to do what I want, when I want, how I want to do it, no matter the cost to somebody else. I am going to determine my own way of living. I don't care what other people say about what the world is like and how we're supposed to give our morals. I can do it on my own. Determine for ourselves right from wrong. But it's a shift to fear of the Lord, to be in awe of God's goodness and his greatness to such a degree that we don't want to dishonor this God. We don't want to grieve him because he's so great. And that becomes the moral driving compass of our lives, that he is the one that we fear. Fear of the Lord receives wisdom and acts on it because we don't want to dishonor God. God is the one who determines for us because he made us. He knows the fabric of the moral fabric of the world and relationships, and we trust him to teach us how to live and how to move and how to relate to one another and how to make decisions that are beneficial for others and good for others and honoring to him. Verses 9 and 10 also have a from to an honoring of the Lord with our wealth and resources, but it's from an attitude of total ownership of our own goods and wealth to a stewardship of our goods and resources. Self-centeredness has this kind of narrative to it. This is my wealth. I worked hard for this. Those are my resources. I will determine what to do with it, how I want to do with it, in what ways. We get offended if God says be generous at times. I'll determine what I do with my wealth and resources. But God-centeredness says something different. God-centeredness says everything that I have is a gift. Even the strength, the ingenuity, the nerve to make the wealth that I've made, That's all a gift as well. Everything that I have, everything I experience is a gift. It's a gift given to me for a time, and I am a steward of all that the Lord has entrusted to me. It's toward an understanding of being entrusted. And therefore, God, if you've entrusted this to me, I will use it to your glory and to your honor. All of Proverbs' wisdom about wealth and resources, giving to the poor, lending well, paying back what we've borrowed. It's all built on this understanding that we are stewards of what God has generously, graciously given to us. Now, each of these from twos has a benefit attached to them, a promise, as it were, about what life will be like if you live this way in a God-centered way, rather than a self-centered way. If we bind ourselves to love and faithfulness, verse 4, the Father tells the Son that you will experience favor with humans and with God, and you experience good success. I mean, it makes sense. If you and I are faithful to our promises and we seek to do well to other people and care for them, we're going to have all kinds of favor from other people. People are going to love us because we've cared for them well. If we choose God's paths over our own way of doing things, over determining self-determination, the Father says in verse 6 that God will direct your paths. Your paths will be straight. And the idea of straight paths in the ancient world was you don't have a rocky, you're not going on a path that you're going to fall off of, or a tight turn where there might be a robber on the other side who can jump you, a dangerous road. It's a straight road where you can see where you're going and you know that there's no danger ahead and you're not going to fall. Success, in other words, will avoid harm for our lives if we walk God's straight paths before us. If we live according to God's morals, verse 8 promises us that we will experience health and refreshment for our bones. Pastor Prince and I were talking this week. He said a line that was just so poignant. He said, sin is exhausting. That's exactly right. It's exhausting. See somebody who's trapped in sin, and they're exhausted. The Bible says if you give yourself to the fear of the Lord, it's actually refreshment to your bones. It's beautiful to go to sleep with a clean conscience. Refreshment, healing. Stewardship of God's resources has a promise attached to it as well. Financial stability in verse 10. The ability to be increasingly generous with what God has given us. Our vats. The vats are filled with wine, and we have more than all that we need if we honor the Lord with our resources. Those are the promises. And this is where it gets a little dangerous. And we need to be careful, because some people will stop there and say, if you're perfect in obedience and you do all these things, then you will experience all these promises in life. But these are not strict promises. Proverbs is a little bit more complex than that. These are benefits that'll come to us, but we need to understand a few things about God's world and where we're going if we're going to read Proverbs rightly. It's important to remember that these promises about health and wellness, about abundance of goods, about paths and favor, that all that is actually ultimately fulfilled not in this life. Those things will be fulfilled in the new heavens and new earth. If you read Revelation 21 about what God promises in the new heavens and the new earth and the new creation when Jesus returns, it's a setting where these things are actually taking place fully and completely with no harm whatsoever. And so we need to remember that Proverbs isn't just only talking about this life. We might experience some of the things talked about here in this life if we give ourselves to them. But ultimately what Proverbs is going toward is something out in the future when Jesus returns. A new heavens and a new earth, a new creation. Ultimate healing will come for our bones with the resurrection when Jesus returns. Straight paths, no harm will come to us in the new heavens and new earth, because there will be no one who will sin against us, and we will sin against no other. In the resurrection, you and I will treat everyone with great dignity. You will never sin against somebody ever again. You will never demean somebody else ever again. You'll never use sarcasm ever again.
Hallelujah.
Ooh. The front row's hot today. It's amazing. It's amazing, right? That's where things are going. And we need to remember this because you and I, right here, right now, even with these promises and going into the future, we will still experience some truth to them here in this life, but we are still, right here, right now, stuck in a broken world. We're stuck in a broken world. So you can honor the Lord with all of your financial resources and still experience financial ruin. Why? Well, there's a proverb for that. By justice, a king builds up the land, but he who exacts gifts, some translations have heavy taxation, tears it down, Proverbs 29:4. You could honor the Lord with your wealth, and an employee embezzles all that you have, or a good section of what you have. We still live in a broken world. Fearing the Lord and turning from evil most of the time will be refreshing to the bones. Like I said, it's wonderful, it's delightful to live with a clean conscience. It's refreshing to not carry around guilt and shame and try to hide and make sure people don't know what you've done. But people who fear the Lord still get cancer. We live in a broken world. The fear of the Lord often doesn't overcome genetics. Fearing the Lord in the midst of this broken world may mean that you're staying the course in faithfulness to the Lord, and that puts you at odds with the culture, the host culture in which the gospel has been planted. And you will face opposition because of fear of the Lord. There are other contexts right here, right now, in our planet, around the world, where brothers and sisters are fearing the Lord and they're in jail. That's not refreshment to the bones. This is one of the reasons why the father in this proverb prepares his son to endure discipline. Because we're still in a broken world. The father calls his son to a God-centeredness with suffering and difficulty and hardships. And these words are tender. Parents, if you've ever spoken to your sons or daughters this way, you can put yourself in this spot and you can see how this father's talking to his son. They're tender, but they're so clear. My son, verse 11, do not despise the Lord's discipline or be weary of his reproof. For the Lord reproves him whom he loves as a father the son in whom he delights. No parent wants to see his child or her child experience hardship and pain, but in this world we will. And we need to prepare our children for it. And we need to be prepared for it. That's why the Proverbs has it here. Because wisdom is to be gained if we approach the discipline of the Lord with a humble heart. Now, discipline can take two different forms. One is when we are not disciplined in areas of our lives, God will discipline us. Where we don't honor, where we don't fear, where we don't trust the Lord out of love, and we make self-centered decisions, those self-centered decisions will have consequences to them, will hopefully be painful to us. And what the Father is telling the Son is, when that pain comes into your life because you've made a foolish decision out of a sinful, self-centered heart, you've substituted yourself for God and you've made that decision, when that comes into your life, heed it, listen to it, pay attention to it, and turn. See, the Lord seeks to bring pain into our lives when we veer off the path to bring us back. Like a shepherd with a hook will yank the sheep back. Come back to the path, it's dangerous over there. No telling what the sheep was thinking as this hook comes by and grabs him. What are you doing to me? And the Lord's discipline is out of love for us. If you're sinning right now in some significant ways, and you know that you're sinning in significant ways, and you think you're getting away with it, that's not God being merciful. He may be giving you over to it. Listen and turn. Listen and turn. It's out of love for us. An example, someone who cannot control their anger will eventually start to lose relationships around them. It's a natural consequence for being an angry woman, an angry man. You start to lose relationships. And the temptation in that spot is to start to blame God and blame others for the circumstances that you're in. Proverbs 19:3 mentions this as well. When a man's folly brings his way to ruin, his heart rages against the Lord. He's brought ruin to his life by folly, and he gets angry at God. No, the ruin is intended to discipline you, to bring you back, to bring you back. It's intended to humble us from self-centeredness and bring us back to God-centeredness. And this is good and painful. Malcolm Muggeridge wrote these words, "Suppose you eliminated suffering. What a dreadful place the world would be. Because everything that corrects dependency of man to feel over-important and over-pleased with himself would disappear. He's bad enough now. But what would he would be absolutely intolerable if he never suffered." So there's one form of discipline that can come our way. But there is this other side of discipline that comes our way that's, I think, in some ways harder emotionally and for our hearts and minds to wrestle with, and that is when other people sin, when other people are foolish, and we experience the pain of their folly. What's up with that? How do we handle this senseless suffering? Well, it's one way to remember that, you know, if we live in an economic system that is unjust and it doesn't reward ingenuity, doesn't reward good business decisions, and you start to lose all your money because of that, I mean, that's suffering because of somebody else's decisions. How do we take that? The Bible says to take that as discipline as well. But not so much because of some thing that's in you that's an immediate cause to this discipline, but because God is trying to train us to be more like his son. God is trying to protect us from things that have not yet been. He's trying to prepare us and protect us from things that he sees that can be dangerous in our lives if we learn from the discipline. I love that we just sang the song, "Nothing's Wasted," because that's what this is getting at. Nothing in our lives is wasted in God's hands. Everything is used for us. Elizabeth Elliot tells of her experience with a shepherding family in northern Wales. She says, or here's the setup to it. There was a parasite in that area that would cause great difficulty and suffering to the sheep and could actually cause death to many of them. So once a year, the shepherd, he had to fill up a huge vat of his highly toxic antiseptic, and he had to immerse each of these sheep in this vat and cover them up, and not just their feet and shoulders, but their head, their ears, their noses, their snouts, everything. And he had to hold them under the water until their skin was saturated with the antiseptic to rescue them from what would otherwise likely have killed them. And Elizabeth writes this, "One by one, John, who's the shepherd, sees the animals. They would struggle to climb out of the side, and Mac, the sheepdog, would snarl and snap at their faces to force them back under. And when they tried to climb up the ramp into the panicky way at the far end, the farmer would catch them, spin them around, and force them to go back under again, holding them ears, eyes, and nose submerged for a few seconds. And as their lord and master was pushing their head under, drowning them at least as far as they could tell, their panicky little eyes would look up over the edge of the vat. It was so easy to see what they were thinking. What is God doing to me? What is a shepherd doing to me? Elizabeth Elliot says, I've had some experiences in my life which have made me feel very sympathetic to those poor sheep. There are times I couldn't figure out any reason for the treatment I was getting from the great shepherd whom I trusted, and like these sheep, I didn't have any hint of explanation at the time. Just as those sheep thought it was senseless, we can think it is senseless as well. But we take that pain, we see it, we learn from it, and we trust that God is keeping us from a greater pain when he brings us through that pain. But how do we know we can trust this God? How do we know that we can stay, and how do we stay God-centered when everything in us wants to go back to self-centered and self-protection? How do we stay God-centered? And this is where our God-centered hearts need to be secured by a steadfast love. In verse 3 of this section, the Father tells the Son, let love and faithfulness never leave you. Let love and faithfulness never leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. Now, there's some ambiguity in the text. And if you were to look at the commentators would be split between, is it humans that are supposed to be characterized by love and faithfulness? And we want to say, yep. And others say, well, is it God who, that is it his love and faithfulness that we should bind around our necks, that we should write on the tablet of our hearts? And you want to say, yeah. Why? Well, because there's, I think, an intentional ambiguity in the text. This phrase, love and faithfulness, that phrase is actually sort of like a code word that God uses to describe himself. Love and faithfulness. In the book of Exodus, which is in the Old Testament as well, one of the first five books of the Bible, God has brought the people of Israel out of Egypt, and he has brought them into the wilderness, and he's given them his commands, so he's redeemed them, and he's given them his commands about how to live, and there's been a rebellion and idolatry, and everything's a mess. Moses gets mad, it's horrible, breaks the commandments, it's a big mess. Eventually, Moses is talking to God and says, God, show me your glory. Then I will be able to carry on. Just show me your glory. And God says to Moses, if I show you my glory, you won't live. So this is what I'll do. I'll hide you in a rock, and I'll pass by. You'll be able to see the trail behind me. Then you'll see. And what's fascinating is as God does that, he speaks out loud so that Moses can hear. He self-defines who he is. He sings it seems. The Lord passed before Moses, it says, and he proclaimed this, the Lord, a God merciful and gracious, slow to anger, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. Did you hear it? Love and faithfulness, abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness, keeping steadfast love for thousands, forgiving iniquity and transgression and sin, but who will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the children's children to the third and the fourth generation. God is the one who's abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. He's the one that we need to write or that we need to bind around our neck. Remember God's steadfast love and faithfulness, to take that steadfast love and faithfulness and to write it on our hearts. And what's amazing about the Bible is that it's going somewhere. In the book of Proverbs, you're able to look back on what God did in Egypt and how he delivered the people of God out of slavery to Egypt. And he gave them the commandments. He gave them the priesthood. He gave them kingship. He gave them all these great kinds of things. He brought them from nothing, and he made them into a strong, powerful nation. And so the people of Israel were able to look back on that and remember God's steadfast love and faithfulness. And you and I have even more reason to remember God's steadfast love and faithfulness, to bind it around our necks and to write it onto our hearts. Because hundreds of years after Proverbs 3 was written, we read this about Jesus. The word of the Lord became flesh. Some would translate that, the wisdom of God became flesh. He dwelt among us. We have seen his glory, the glory as of the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. That phrase, grace and truth, is translated also love and faithfulness. It's the same words in Greek that are translated into Hebrew, love and faithfulness. We have seen his love and faithfulness. For from his fullness have come, we have received grace upon grace, for the law was given through Moses. The law was given through Moses. Grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. Love and faithfulness came through Jesus Christ. No one has ever seen God, the only God who is at the Father's. He has made him known. See, the law set up the structures, and Jesus now brought grace and truth. Jesus now brought a full expression of what love and faithfulness looks like in himself. How did he do it? By walking the straight path that God made for him. Remember Proverbs 3, 5, and 6, some of the most quoted verses of Proverbs. Trust in the Lord with all your heart, lean not on your understanding. In all your ways acknowledge him, and he will make your paths straight. Remember what John the Baptist said about Jesus? Prepare the way of the Lord, make straight his paths. Where was the Lord preparing Jesus' paths to go? Straight to the cross. Straight to the cross where a son who fully feared the Lord, a son who always trusted in God, took the penalty for our sin. Receive the penalty for our folly. That's where the cross led Jesus. Why can we trust this God even when it seems like our paths are crooked? Even when there's unhealth in our bodies? Even when it's hard for our ends to meet? How? Why? We've written the steadfast love of the Lord upon our hearts because we know that this Father has sent his Son to walk the straight path to the cross. John Stott has said that at the heart of sin is we substitute ourselves in the place of God, self-centeredness. At the heart of salvation, at the heart of forgiveness, is God substitutes himself for us in his Son. We write the steadfast love of the Lord on our hearts by remembering that the Father sent the Son to live for us and die for us and rise again for us. He gets what we deserve so that we get what he deserves.